Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, June 21st, 2019. President Salva Kiir sends a team to mediate in Sudan's political crisis.
We are the closest people to the Sudan, more than anybody, than the Ethiopian. We understand the society. We know their houses. We know where they live. We talk the same language. We don't need translators. And we understand the makeup of the Sudanese society.
And community leaders from oil-producing states say they are not getting their cut from oil revenue.
The minister reported that the 2% has been going to the states. And yet, we are all from states, and many of us also are from the oil-producing states. But also, there's no information.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government has dispatched a team to mediate between Sudan's military leaders and the opposition. A minister in the office of the president says President Salva Kiir is concerned about the situation in Sudan and is urging Khartoum to form a transitional government soon. Mungu Ugale reports for VOA from Khartoum.
South Sudan Presidential Minister Mayig Deng was part of the four-man delegation led by President Kiir's security advisor Tudgat Luak that arrived in Khartoum 2 days ago. Deng told South Sudan in Focus that the president sent a delegation to deliver a message of peace to all Sudanese leaders and to urge them to find an amicable solution to the ongoing settlement between opposition parties and Sudan's transitional military council. Deng says the South Sudanese delegation held a series of meetings with military and political opposition leaders, and what is clear is that all parties are ready to reach a negotiated settlement to the conflict. He says South Sudan can be a great help for the Sudanese people at this critical time.
We are the closest people to the Sudan, more than anybody, than the Ethiopian. We understand the society. We know their houses. We know where they live. We talk the same language. We don't need translators. And we understand the makeup of the Sudanese society. So we can be able to offer them a practical solution that can serve them.
Deng says during their meetings, some Sudanese political forces expressed concerns over what they called exclusion from talks held between the military junta and the Sudanese Professional Association. He says Juba could play a great role in assuring that all Sudanese political forces are brought on board to discuss their country's political future.
We wanted everybody to be included, the traditional political parties and the new political parties, and there were other groups also that were brought in by the agreements that were signed by the previous government with some group from Darfur and the marginalized area of the Sudan. So now they are on board, they're talking to the military council, and we talk to them, and we are going to give the report.
Deng says the Kiir administration will continue to engage other Sudanese armed groups such as the SPLM North in the Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan and urge them to join the peace process soon.
They are very happy and they were excited that South Sudan has taken this initiative. We want to return the favor. Then Rudi Jamil, they have helped us to achieve peace. We are here to help them.
Deng says Sudanese leaders have assured his team that Khartoum will continue to be the main guarantor for the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement. He says the Sudanese people believe that the removal of President Omar al-Bashir from office will not affect the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement.
So they are going to help implement the peace because it was Sudan that signed the agreement, not Bashir. Yeah, Bashir signed it on behalf of the Sudan. Sudan and us, we are just one people in two countries. We're divided politically, but we are basically one people.
Deng says President Kiir is expected to host talks between the Sudanese military and opposition leaders in Juba in the coming days to try to work on their differences so that all affected parties become part of the political process in Sudan. Mungu Ugali for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry said the only way to resolve the country's political crisis is through what he calls a comprehensive dialogue to reach solution that safeguards Sudan's security. Sudan's military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhani said the ruling military council is ready for talks with the umbrella movement, the Alliance for Freedom and Change, and other political groups without preconditions. Paul Nyantulia, Research Associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed Al-Ashinawi about the possible scenarios in Sudan.
One possibility is that the military leaders that are part of this group that calls itself the Transitional Military Council are feeling the heat of the suspension from the African Union, the heavy condemnation by the international community over the crackdown on civilian protesters, the continued domestic pressure by the Alliance for Freedom and Change, and certainly some of them appear to have realized the importance of offering compromises in order to salvage what little credibility they have in an effort to try and prolong their stay in power. So that is one assessment. The other assessment is that contradictions are now sharpening inside the Transitional Military Council between those who would like to press on with negotiations and restore the country to some kind of normalcy, and those hardliners that continue to be aligned with General Dagalo, also known as Hemeti. Most independent observers believe that Hemeti is the real power behind this military body. And if this assessment is correct, then it means that General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the leader of this so-called Transitional Military Council, is trying to assert his authority. But the situation remains very, very tenuous. It should be recalled that this body is not cohesive at all. It doesn't seem to have a political program. We have not heard about its vision for the future of the country. We know very little about its thinking about Sudan's institutional layout, what needs to be done beyond increasing its hold of power. The civil resistance, on the other hand, does have a program. They have a draft constitution, they have a draft governmental framework, and they have a series of milestones that should be achieved in the course of a transition.
Is there any room for a compromise with the African foreign ministers meeting in Ethiopia seeking some sort of mediation?
The room for compromise will remain small as long as four issues remain unaddressed. One, the hardliners aligned with Hemeti and by extension with Egypt, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, if they continue to hold sway within this body that calls itself the Transitional Military Council, there'll be very little room for compromise. Second, if the international community fails to act with one voice, then there'll be very, very little scope for genuine dialogue. Third, if the African Union abandons its call for the speedy return of power to civilian hands, then compromise could be very difficult. And the concern is that the African Union has differed before, taken very strong positions, and then backed down from those positions in situations such as Burundi and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the fourth is if a full investigation on those responsible for the tragic violence that was meted out against civilians that were gathering peacefully around the Ministry of Defense at the headquarters, if that investigation does not get underway, then I'm afraid that the room for compromise will be very, very small.
Protesters and riot groups say the brutal crackdown was carried out by the feared paramilitary rapid support forces led by General Dagalo, the deputy chief of the ruling military council. But Burhan defended the paramilitary group, saying there are some groups raising suspicions about the RSF to try to get them out of the political scene, but the RSF are an integral part of the armed forces. What does that mean?
You know, Mohammed, this is yet another indication of the lack of cohesion among those officers that are sitting in the Transitional Military Council. And you see, the worry is that the more this crisis prolongs, the more we see radical elements trying to assert control and dictate the pace of the transition. Now, the rapid support forces have their roots in the Janjaweed militia. These are militia that have been associated with gross human rights violations, rising to the level of mass atrocities and crimes against humanity in Darfur, according to all international investigations. The commander of the RSF, Mr. General Dagalo, believes that the only viable way for the RSF to rescue itself from further international sanctions and to avoid accountability is to hold on to power to the greatest extent possible and to edge out those within the Transitional Military Council body who see genuine negotiations as the only viable path forward. So this struggle is far from over and it will continue indefinitely.
That's Paul Nyantulia of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed Al-Ashinawi. Members of the Council of States, the upper house of South Sudan's parliament, are questioning Finance Minister Salvatore Garang about 2% of the country's oil revenue to oil-producing states as per the 2013 Petroleum Revenue Management Act. The lawmaker says the government must prove the money goes towards providing basic services for oil-producing communities. Viola Elias reports for VOA from Juba.
Finance Minister Garang appeared before the Council of State yesterday after the lawmakers summoned him to explain why the government was not remitting oil revenues to oil-producing areas as required by law. The Petroleum Revenue Management Act 2013 requires the government to remit 2% of the net petroleum revenue to oil-producing states and give back 3% to the states from the net petroleum revenue. Garang told MPs oil-producing states are getting their shares of oil revenues on a monthly basis. But Mary Ayen Majok, who represents Ruend State in the Council of States, believes the government has not transferred any oil revenue money.
The minister reported that the 2% has been going to the states. And yet we are all from states, and many of us also are from the oil-producing states. But also there's no information.
Speaking in Arabic, Joseph Abant, who represents Fashoda State in the Council of States, demanded that Garang provides proof of where the money sent to oil-producing states has gone, noting communities in those areas continue to lack basic services like clean water and health care.
Communities in South Sudan, specifically in the oil-producing areas, such as Roeng and Northern Upper Nile, if you know Roeng communities, they have been suffering from December last year just to get drinking water. The communities of Roeng State are supposed to get water if the money was used for its purposes. We don't have any report from the oil so that we can know where is our 2%.
When asked to produce detailed figures of the money transferred to oil-producing states, Garang asked the lawmakers to give him more time.
Cannot give you the data now. Anything which concerns an account must be produced with the details from the bank. And so I will not come here and give you figures in my head. When you get any information, our account section will ask the central bank to send us what are the balances in these two accounts. And since we started in 2005, then we took over the responsibility in 2011. And so the data is there, and we will produce it, including the amount which we have sent to the states, especially the 2%.
Residents from oil-producing areas says they have seen nothing to show for their shares of oil revenues from the government. Michael Chol is from the Molut oil-producing area of Upper Nile.
These are the questions. Wherever you go and you ask the communities or the one of the members, they will still actually irritating the same question. But since this right was given to community, there is no money or there is no development I've seen by the communities that can be say this is a 2% project since 2011.
Speaking in Arabic, Fadil Nut yields from northern Upper Nile area where several South Sudanese oil fields are located.
The first time we received our share was in 2007 when the minister visited the area, according to my knowledge, but after the separation immediately, the percentage stopped coming in, and we don't know where it goes from 2011 until now. The communities have not received even 1%. Right now, the state has nothing, no hospital, no roads, and increased sickness just from the oil production.
Lawmakers in South Sudan's upper house of parliament are demanding that the Ministry of Finance proves that the part of country's oil revenue is going back to the oil-producing communities. So far, that has not happened. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudan approves a $1 billion contract to build a university in Bor. Find out who won the contract when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what important life-saving technique do you know?
I was once a member of Red Cross, so I was trained to give first aid, for example, to a baby who is choking you get. Then to give first aid to someone who has had a fractured dislocation. Yeah, that's all.
Self-defense. It is a life-saving technique because the city where we are now has lots of thugs everywhere. And if you have that self-defense, it really, at least they may take what they want from you, but it saves your life.
When someone has drawn into a water, let me say, was swimming, you pull him or her up from the water, and then you pump the water out, and you give him oxygen for her with a kiss of life.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The World Health Organization is lamenting the slow progress in tackling hepatitis B in Africa. The WHO says only 3 of the continent's 47 countries are on track to eliminate the disease. Health experts say the prevalence rate in Nigeria is high. Mike Monye has the story for VOA from Lagos.
WHO says hepatitis B affects 1 in every 15 people in the African region and is becoming a bigger killer than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Dr. Fumilayo Olesi says Nigeria has one of the highest rates of hepatitis B in the world at 10%. That means about 20 million Nigerians are living with the disease. Lesi is a consultant gastroenterologist with the Lagos University Teaching Hospital. She spoke at a scientific conference of the Society for Gastroenterology and Hepatology of Nigeria last month. Lesi says some Nigerians are engaged in dangerous practices like using unsterilized kits in barber's shop, which can cause the disease. Medical experts have been expressing concerns about WHO's reports on efforts to tackle the disease in Africa. WHO says only 3 countries, Uganda, Cape Verde, and Rwanda, are on track to eliminate the disease. Dr. Kimola Olukayode is a consultant clinical pathologist with the Lagos University Teaching Hospital. He says people often put themselves at higher risk by not going for treatment when they contact it.
Hepatitis B in itself is not a death sentence per se. It now becomes a big issue when intervention is not sought, either by way of the person not being aware of his or her status, and then beyond that, not following up if he or she is being found to have the condition.
Essentially, hepatitis inflammation of the liver, and it doesn't manifest itself immediately. Dr. Lukayode says it is a preventable disease and requires that people be tested.
Hepatitis is actually a preventable disease in that what is important is that once the person carries out a test to know whether he or she has the disease, if the person is negative, you should go for the vaccine. The vaccines are free in some centers, while in some places it's just a token of about less than $5.
Medical experts urge the Nigerian government to declare a state of emergency on the disease as it did for AIDS, malaria, and Ebola. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
Heads of states and cabinet ministers from at least 30 African countries are expected to take part in the inaugural African Union and United Nations Wildlife Economy Summit starting Sunday. The agenda is expected to include strategies for managing wildlife resources to benefit African economies. Paddy Gondo reports.
Prominent among the attendees to the summit in Victoria Falls are countries such as Zambia, Botswana, Namibia, and Angola, and Zimbabwe, which fall under what is termed the CASA region. CASA is an acronym for the Kavango-Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area. It is an area located where the national borders of the 5 countries converge. Observers say the area may now be a victim of successful conservation efforts over time. The area is home to 61% of the world elephant population. The latest elephant surveys indicate a population of at least 220,000 elephants across the 5 CASA countries, with 85% concentrated in Botswana and Zimbabwe. The total figure for African elephants stands at 415,000. The AU Wildlife Summit comes against the background of a recent lifting of a hunting ban on elephants by Botswana and a summit by countries within the CASA region last month in Kasane, Botswana. The Kasane Summit leaders communique mentions, amongst other things, that the human elephant conflict is escalating in much of the elephant range due to competition for limited resources and the effects of climate change. The crux of the Khaza country's position is the need to balance the conservation of wildlife and the human economic interest within the region. The spokesperson for summit host country Zimbabwe, National Parks and Wildlife, Tinashe Farao, speaks on the matter, saying the rangers are battling an overpopulation of animals.
Over the last 5 years, we have lost more than 200 lives due to human wildlife conflict. Of those 200 lives, 40% of them, they are human elephant conflict. This year alone, we have lost 15 lives. Of those 15 lives, between 38% and 40%, they are human elephant conflict. Other animals, over the weekend, we lost about two people who were attacked by a hippo in Gashagashikari. And apart from people losing their lives, hundreds of people have been injured. And as if that is not enough, people have lost their crops. We have more than 70,000 hectares of crops which have been destroyed over the last 5 years. People's livelihoods are being destroyed.
Zimbabwe's elephant population, according to a recent census, estimates that the Wange National Park's elephant population stands at 53,949, way above the ecological carrying capacity of 40,000 elephants. Zimbabwe is therefore arguing for the lifting of the international ban on endangered species, CITES, and what it and other CASA members refer to as sustainable utilization of wildlife resources.
That's why we are saying to the international community, why don't you allow us to manage these elephants? Why don't you allow us to manage the population? Because they've exceeded their carrying capacity. That's why we are trying to sell some of them. And what do the Kasane meeting resolved that our people must benefit from the resource, especially those people who live next to wild animals. Right now we are facing a drought. There are a lot of climate change induced drought, and there is no water. We pump water for our animals. Where do we get the money to pump water for our animals? And we are saying these animals must pay for their upkeep.
Some observers, however, say that the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, Flora and Fauna is there to protect the dwindling populations of endangered species. Elephant populations in southeast Angola and southwest Zambia have suffered major declines due to poaching, a fact which has not been lost on wildlife activists such as the World Wildlife Foundation, WWF. The area of Kavango and Zambezi, formerly known as Caprivi, in Namibia, are especially hit by poaching activity, although there are reports that the elephant populations are reportedly growing. The demand for ivory is largely coming from Asia and China in particular. The U.S. banned imports of spot-hunted trophies into the U.S., though the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a memo on March 1, 2018, pledging to withdraw its 2017 Endangered Species Act findings for trophies of African elephants from Zimbabwe and Zambia. The findings led to the lifting of the ban on importing elephant trophies from those countries, preferring to see the applications to import trophies on a case-by-case basis. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
Still in Zimbabwe, tensions are running high and frustrations are evident after two men were arrested for insulting and undermining President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Hosea Zenvashi has more from Harare.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa came into power in November 2017 through a military coup and won his own term last July. At his inauguration, he promised a new and democratic Zimbabwe.
This is a different Zimbabwe, the dawn of the Second Republic. Following my commitment to open up the democratic space, the period since that special day, 24th November 2017, has indeed been momentous. In just 9 months, we have birthed a new Zimbabwe and forged a different path for our nation, a path full of freedoms, democracy, transparency, love and harmony.
Almost a year later, Mnangagwa's rule is leaving a foul aftertaste of his predecessor, Robert Mugabe, under whom citizens could get arrested for criticizing his rule. Tinashe Dembo is in custody pending his trial later this month. His crime, like many in the Mugabe regime, was to say, open quote, President Emmerson Mnangagwa is a fool who has failed to manage the Zimbabwean economy to an extent that everything is now expensive, including beer, close quote. Zimbabwe has a lot of draconian laws that have often been used to crack down on opposing views against the state and the ruling party. Kumbirai Mafunda is with the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, a non-profit that provides legal aid to those charged under such laws.
Since 2017, when President Emmerson Mnangagwa came over as the leader of the country, we have noted a number of people who have been arrested and charged for allegedly insulting or undermining the authority of the president. We have seen the use of the Criminal Law Codification Reform Act to criminalize free speech.
The Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights are also helping another man arrested on a similar charge. Mafunda says there has been an escalation of government efforts to curtail free speech. Doug Coulthard is a lawyer and human rights defender.
That provision of the criminal code undermining the president or insulting the president is totally unconstitutional. That provision, it violates the right to freedom of expression. It undermines people's ability to hold the executive accountable. These are elected public officials who should be held accountable.
Coulthard says freedom of expression is being violated every day in Zimbabwe. Political activists that are arrested are often prohibited to speak on social media or to the media as part of their bail conditions. And the state media has often been used to attack government critics. Mafunda says the government should realign the laws of the land with the constitution and do away with such repressive laws. He says the Mnangagwa regime is similar to that of his predecessor and mentor, Mugabe. Coulthard, on the other hand, says the Mnangagwa regime outpaces Mugabe's by a wide margin in the number of people charged with attempting to subvert the government. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
That's our show for this Friday. We'll now leave you with the song Run Deed by M.A. Stars.
We've
been listening to M-Stars with the song Run Deed. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a peaceful weekend. And please remember to join us on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Jonathan Halleman. I had a child.
Tingaro, we are lamenting.